From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, the Saudi king is dead, the president's State of the Union, and Deflategate takes over. King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia has died after nearly two decades on the throne. Saudi state TV announced his passing, and the king was buried in a simple ceremony in Riyadh today.
بيان من الديوان الملكي ببالغ الأسى والحزن.
الله أكبر. In his State of the Union address, the president had it his way in front of a Republican Congress.
Middle class economics works. Expanding opportunity works. And these policies will continue to work as long as politics don't get in the way.
And uproar over air pressure in footballs on the way to the Super Bowl. Here's New England Patriots coach Bill Belichick yesterday saying he knows nothing.
Critics. I have nothing. I don't have an explanation.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Abdelrahim Fukara of Al Jazeera, Kristen Welker of NBC, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's your top story this week? The State of the Union, the Middle East, Deflategate? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. From Washington, we're joined by Abdelrahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera. Abdelrahim Fukara, welcome back to On Point.
Good to be with you, Tom, again.
Also from Washington, the great Kristen Welker joins us, White House correspondent for NBC News. Kristen, it's great to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me back. Great to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Abdelrahim and Kristen.
Abdelrahim, let's go first to the Arabian Peninsula. I don't know if it's even a fair question, but what's the bigger story? The Saudi change in the monarchy, the death of the king, the new king Salman, or this turmoil we see in Yemen? What's the significance of each?
Well, I think it's almost impossible to separate the two, what's happening in Saudi Arabia with what's happening in Yemen. I think for the situation in Yemen, it could not have, the death of the king of Saudi Arabia, King Abdullah, could not have come at a more critical time. It's amazing that on the same day that the death of the king was announced, the resignation of the government of Yemen, including President Hadi, was also announced. There are huge question marks now about the future of Yemen. Yemen is obviously very important to all sorts of people in addition to Yemenis. It's so important to all sorts of players. It's critical to Saudi Arabia. What happens in Yemen is critically important to the security and stability of Saudi Arabia. The part of the critical importance for the Saudis in Yemen is that the group, the rebel group that is now in almost full control in Sana'a, seems to be supported, at least those are the reports that we've been getting, by Iran. And if you know the relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia is not good, you can obviously palpably feel how nervous the Saudis would be feeling now.
Jack Beatty, President Obama has, in clear memory, pointed to Yemen as an example of a partner in the U.S. efforts against terrorism where things were working.
Yes, that was just in September. He said, quote, "The strategy of taking out terrorists who threaten us while supporting partners on the front lines is one that we have successfully pursued in Yemen and Somalia for years." John McCain tweeted yesterday, "More problems in President Obama's anti-terror success story. It doesn't look like a success story now." And of course, he was citing that as a model for what we could do in Syria, with the Syrian opposition playing the role of the now deposed Yemeni government.
Kristen Welker, I think we hear Joe Biden already on his way to Saudi Arabia. Perhaps he's on the ground there already to bring his greetings as a new king comes in and the old king is mourned. How does Washington, the White House, see that all of this change in Sana'a and in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia factoring into security issues in the Middle East?
Well, I think there is a lot of concern here. As you point out, Vice President Biden will be leading the delegation representing the United States to pay respects and offer condolences to King Abdullah's family. Mm-hmm. But certainly they are watching Yemen with deep concern here. As you've been pointing out, Yemen's a key partner in the fight against AQAP, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And so the question for the White House, what happens now? Do they abandon their drone policy? The Houthis, who've just come into power, see drones as a violation of Yemen's sovereignty. So do they violate Yemen's sovereignty moving forward? What steps do they take? And they would acknowledge they were somewhat caught off guard by the developments of yesterday. And I think one of the key concerns right now is just the safety of U.S. personnel. They've evacuated much of the embassy, mm-hmm. although it is my understanding that at this hour it still remains open. But concern about the safety of Americans and U.S. policy there moving forward.
Abdurrahim, the new group that's coming, not new, but the group that's now come into power with the resignation of the president and the cabinet there, the Houthi, they're supposed to be, not at all inclined in a friendly way toward al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP we hear about in Yemen. On the other hand, they don't want U.S. drones, and those have been a big part of the pushback on that front. Is this group seen as an effective stopper on al-Qaeda in Yemen, AQAP or not?
Well, I mean, for several weeks now, we've been hearing about some amorphous relationship developing between the Houthis and the United States, various reports that have been given the lie by both the Houthis and the Obama administration. Point is that there is obviously no love lost between the Houthis and al-Qaeda. So the Houthis and the United States now find themselves almost on the same side as far as fighting al-Qaeda in Yemen. But that adds an added rub, an added very dangerous rub, which is that the majority Sunnis in Yemen, who obviously are not very happy, or at least those who may not be very happy about the Houthis taking control, mm-hmm. They may find some solace in the fact that al-Qaeda is a major threat to the Houthis. So it all gets tangled together. I can well imagine the Obama administration sitting there scratching their heads, because these are pieces of a jigsaw puzzle that gets messier by the day. And the fact that now you have a new transition to a new king in Saudi Arabia, although the new king, King Salman, says that he's not going to do anything different, long term, it's going to be people are going to be watching whether he will have the same prowess that the former king, who's now dead, King Abdullah, did have in dealing both with the situation inside Saudi Arabia, but also in the neighborhood, particularly in Yemen. I think Yemen will continue to be a thorn in the side of the Saudis. And because it's going to be a thorn in the side of the Saudis, it's going to basically make the conundrum for the United States all the more complicated.
Allies and enemies getting very tricky here. Yemeni allies out of power. The U.S. signaling recently that it may not go after Assad in Syria so hard because things are getting in such a mess there. And then you've got Congress, John Boehner, the Republicans in Congress, inviting the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, to address a joint session of Congress, to stand in the same place that President Obama stood this week to give a State of the Union address, without the White House being part of this invitation. Very unusual. Here's John Boehner, House Speaker, talking about that decision to invite Netanyahu without first informing President Obama.
I did not consult with the White House. The Congress can make this decision on its own. I don't believe I'm poking anyone in the eye. There is a serious threat that exists in the world. And the president last night kind of papered over it. And the fact is that there needs to be a more serious conversation in America about how serious the threat is.
And he wants to have it with the Prime Minister of Israel. Christian Welker, how out of the ordinary is this invitation and acceptance without the White House even being in it?
Well, I think it's a complete break from protocol, and I can tell you the White House was just incensed by it. Officially, White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest said, look, the protocol is that a head of state invites another head of state to speak, certainly, or just invites them to the country. But in this instance, as you point out, the president wasn't alerted. The White House was caught off guard. And just a little bit of background, it came a day after President Obama, during a State of the Union address, vowed to veto any legislation that would bring new sanctions against Iran during these nuclear talks. He says that any new sanctions would scuttle those talks. Republicans, some Democrats agree they want to see new legislation. House Speaker John Boehner knows that if Prime Minister Netanyahu comes, he's going to call for more sanctions against Iran. So the House Speaker saying he's not poking his thumb in the eye of President Obama, but the White House sees it very differently. They are saying, and I think one of the most interesting developments came yesterday when the White House said the president's not going to meet with Prime Minister Netanyahu because his arrival here in March is just 2 weeks before he's up for re-election. And so they say that it is White House protocol not to meet with leaders who are headed for re-election because it might sway the election. But behind the scenes here, they are angry.
Jack, what a picture. The Israeli Prime Minister standing in front of a joint session of Congress saying, what? Your president's a fool asleep at the switch? I'll tell you what's up. And I mean, maybe so, but wow, what a scene.
What a scene. And Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper today, quotes a senior American official saying, Netanyahu ought to remember that President Obama has a year and a half left to his presidency and that there will be a price. Well, that's a pretty stiff warning. Meanwhile, also out of Israel this morning, the Mossad told U.S. Senators over the weekend that, quote, any passage of the sanction bill, the Kirk-Menendez bill in Congress, would be, quote, a grenade thrown into the negotiations with Iran. It would blow up nearly two years of very careful work upon which, really, peace depends, the success of which.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Saudi king dead. Yemen chaos. The president's State of the Union. Deflategate. Balls. We're joined by White House correspondent for NBC News, Kristen Welker. By the Washington bureau chief for Al Jazeera. Great to have him with us this week. In particular, Abdurrahim Fukara. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. Wendy in Hartford, Connecticut. Thank you for calling, Wendy. You're on the air.
Well, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm working at home and listening, as I often do on Friday, and so appreciate the roundtable approach that you use.
Great.
I've never called before, but I need to...
What's caught your eye this week, Wendy?
Yeah, well, what caught my eye is the lack of outrage and shock and shock and awe in the commentary about what you were just speaking about, Mr. Boehner inviting Netanyahu to come to our Congress, the People's Congress, my capital, without coordinating with our president.
Well, what's the problem with it? He knows the prime minister's phone number in Israel. You can reach out and invite him.
But what I find amazing is people that, including Mr. Boehner, who have spent many months, in fact, the last several years, complaining that the president doesn't respect the Constitution, doesn't respect our government, doesn't respect the American people. In fact, doing something that looks very much to me, I realize, you know, I'm just a citizen out here. I don't have the constraints of elected office or even of a journalist, but it looks very much to me like the way that somebody would act if they were an anarchist or if they did not respect the rule of law, they did not respect precedent.
But, precedent, I get. Rule of law, I don't know. Wendy, I appreciate your call. Kristen Welker, what exactly is being offended here? The president, of course, isn't happy to have a head of state of another country invited here to address the joint session of Congress without even being given a heads up. But there's no law that says John Boehner can't do this.
There's no law. I think that the caller brings up a really fascinating point, though, which is the optics of this situation. And in politics, optics matter a lot. And House Speaker John Boehner knows it. He knows that this is to some extent, a swipe at the president and saying, you can't act unilaterally. Congress deserves a vote. If we think that sanctions are appropriate, we should be able to move forward with it. And so, in essence, it's his way of saying, we're going to put pressure on you. You are vowing to veto any legislation that would bring new sanctions. We're going to put more pressure on you and make it more difficult for you to veto that legislation. And his move in this case was to invite Prime Minister Netanyahu. So there's absolutely no rule of law against this, but the optics are powerful in this instance.
Abdurrahim, the Israeli Prime Minister, of course, describes Iran's nuclear program as an existential threat, doesn't like the way the administration's going here. Does it look to you as though there's the possibility of a negotiated settlement around this nuclear threat as we speak, Abdurrahim?
Well, I mean, just to go back to what Kristen has just said about the optics, I mean, we were talking earlier in this show about the Obama administration scratching its head trying to figure out what's going on in Saudi Arabia and Yemen. How about people in the Middle East trying to understand how Congress could invite the head of a foreign state to actually address it? And you don't have to look at it through the prism of the Palestinians, who obviously have a big beef with the Israelis. You have to look at it through the prism of the Iranians. President Obama, a few weeks ago, basically when he undertook that bold step talking about wanting to go back to normal with the Cubans, that was interpreted by many people in the region as him saying to the Iranians, look, Congress may now be controlled by the Republicans in both houses, but I can still undertake bold steps. And if I can do that with the Cubans, I can do it with you in Iran. Still, the fact that Netanyahu has been invited to address a joint session of Congress just a few weeks before elections in Israel, probably in terms of optics, will be seen as a damning statement on the position and on the power of the White House. But that's the nature of American democracy. All the upbeat vigor with which he spoke during the State of the Union, to which you alluded earlier, Tom, you have Boehner saying, wait a minute, you say you want to work with us? Here is one for you. See how you deal with this one, because we want to work with Netanyahu, and we know that the dynamics between you and him are not very good. Take this over the Iranian nuclear issue. Here's how we can make your life really difficult with the Iranians. Will that necessarily scupper the deal long term that the president is trying to conclude with the Iranians? I'm not so sure about that. I think the dynamics between the Obama administration and its European allies with the Iranians have moved so far into the field that it's going to be very difficult for Netanyahu to come and scupper that in Congress, particularly as you have the Israeli members of the Israeli Secret Service saying that, hey, guys, don't try to scupper the talks with the Iranians over the nuclear issue.
Real hardball from the Speaker of the House. Of course, the whole scene around the nuclear negotiations is hardball. Sherry in Akron, Ohio. Sherry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I agree with what is happening right now. I believe, first of all, that if we have someone coming from Israel to talk to Congress, I have never, and I've been around many, many years and voted since the early 60s, that I have never seen this done before by a president. I understand.
Seen what done by? So are you glad Boehner has invited Netanyahu or not, Sherry?
Yes.
You're glad?
I am. Absolutely.
And because why? Why exactly?
Two reasons. One, he is bypassing Congress. Why do they, in times past, have had at least the consideration to see and what this is without being overshadowed?
But Sherry, the White House is that's its job to execute American foreign policy.
Absolutely, but in the past we've always taken into consideration what Congress may or may not do.
Yeah.
He has the authority, he's using it, but I think he's using it with a hammer over their head.
It does speak to a gap between the White House and Congress seen on many fronts. One more on this front. We'll get to the State of the Union. Carl in Nashville. You're on the air, Carl. Thanks for calling.
You know, Tom, I pretty much expected the racism from Republicans, from the president. So I'm not surprised at that at all, not anymore. But this, to me, is absolutely shocking. This fundamentally changes how we do business in our republic. And if I was the president, I would pull out the executive order pen and put it on hyperdrive now, because I see that the ruling, the House of Representatives, the Republicans, they do not respect the power of the presidency. And why should I work with these guys when they're going to bring in a guy like Benjamin Netanyahu, who is pretty much foreign leader on in our capital? This is infuriating.
Why? He's prime minister of Israel, a close ally of the United States, Carl.
This is. I don't care. This is our Congress. This is our Senate. He shouldn't be addressing our Congress and our Senate, especially without even notifying the executive order. This is not how this works. We need a nationwide civics class in this country to show people how this works.
Carl, we've got it. I appreciate your call. Kristen Welker, does it look as though the White House and John Kerry, Secretary of State, still have running room to pursue their policy, their strategy with Iran, in spite of this tangle around who's invited where to speak to whom?
Well, I think they do. And Secretary Kerry has made numerous trips to the region and it has really been credited with pushing hard to try to get some type of peace deal done between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And one of the concerns and part of the leverage the White House has right now is that this could really harm that relationship. Some officials saying privately that Secretary Kerry's patience only goes so far, and that he obviously sees this as a swipe as well. So in terms of Iran, I don't think that it's going to stop or limit the administration moving forward and trying to get a nuclear deal done. And I would point out that they say that the chances for getting a deal done are about 50%. So there's not a whole lot of optimism. Mm-hmm. Having said that, you know, the president, Secretary Kerry make the argument they want to give this time to play out. But the question, the big question mark is what happens to the U.S.-Israeli relationship moving forward?
Yemen, Saudi Arabia, Iran and its nukes, Israel and its prime minister. This region takes a lot of American attention. We've got a State of the Union address about this union, this country this week as well. I want to look at that. Here's the president saying this is his big theme. The economy has to work for all Americans.
Will we accept an economy where only a few of us do spectacularly well? Or will we commit ourselves to an economy that generates rising incomes and chances for everyone who makes the effort?
Republican response? Well, first, John Boehner saying, you know, this is a fantasy land that the president was describing in front of Congress.
There's a better way. We need to fix our broken tax code, balance our budget, replace the broken health care law with solutions that lower cost and protect jobs. Veto threats and fantasy land proposals from the White House will not distract the people's house from the people's priorities.
Down the Republican road, and Senator Rand Paul goes further, saying the president just doesn't know how the economy ought to work. It wants a bigger pie, this country does.
The president is intent on redistributing the pie, but not growing it. He misunderstands that the bulk of America wants a bigger pie. They want to work and don't want a hand out, but a hand up.
We'll talk about philosophies. Christian, what's the president want out of this? Does he want something actually passed? Is he drawing a line in the sand? Is he looking at his legacy? Is he looking to 2016's campaign? We all heard that feisty, revved up, let's go president with his view of the world. What does he want out of it?
Well, I think all of the above, actually, Tom. You're right. He was emboldened. He took credit for the economy, basically took a victory lap. Look, the unemployment rate is at 5.6%. When he took office, it was at 7.8%. His approval rating is up, according to our latest poll, at 46%. That's its highest number since October of 2013. So he mapped out these policies, right? Increasing taxes on wealthy Americans to fund middle class priorities, things like education credits, child care credits. And he knows that there's very little chance that any of that is going to pass through this Republican Congress. However, I think part of it has to do with his legacy. He's laying out his legacy. He's saying, look, this is where I want to try to steer the country in the next 2 years. I also think he is absolutely laying down a platform for 2016. And I think he's trying to put pressure on Republicans to get something done. They now own Congress. And right now, they're debating an abortion bill. And a lot of lawmakers within the establishment ranks are concerned that they're not doing what they need to do by 2016, which is to expand the base, to reach out to more people, to appeal to younger voters, to more women, to minorities. And so I think that the president is challenging them, in essence, and also saying to whoever might be the Democratic nominee in 2016, here's your roadmap.
Jack, how did you see the strategy in the president's speech?
Well, I think to follow up on Kristen, that he really wants to consolidate his base. I mean, he did an experiment earlier in the fall, where he made the announcement on immigration, on granting a kind of amnesty or to 5 million people here without papers. His polling went up by an unprecedented 15 points among Hispanic voters. 15 points just in a couple of weeks. Polling experts say they haven't seen anything like that in a long, long time. He's also low, if you look at the polls, he's also low among liberals. They're only in the 70s. And among Democrats.
Why does he
Democrats,
care about his only, base now, Jack?
Well, here's
why. He said, I'm
here's,
not running again. Everybody laughed. He said, I won twice, but why?
I know, but here's why. If he can get to 50% of popularity, that is crucial to any Democrat running after him. I mean, it's not going to matter as much as if he were the nominee, but it will matter a lot. I mean, political scientists are clear. You got to get to 50%. You got to have a good economy to allow anything as almost unprecedented as after two terms, the party being elected for a third time, to allow that to happen, you have to have all the ducks in a row. And that begins by getting those liberals up to, 80%, getting strong Democrats up to 90%, and voila, he will. I think that's his strategy. We'll hand it on to whoever, Hillary, with a 50%, or try to with a 50% approval rate.
David in Atlanta. David, thanks for calling. You're on.
Yes, hi Tom. Thanks very much. As far as the State of the Union and some of the current situations, the things we've heard out of Washington, I think it is almost absurd that John Boehner expects the president, or frankly the Democratic Party, to just roll over and say, yes, we agree with everything you do, let's do it your way.
Well, John Boehner is at the head of the House. We've got a Democratic majority in the Senate. They've got all of Capitol Hill. That should mean something, shouldn't it, David?
Yes, it should mean something, but I think it's absurd, and I think it's absurd for both parties to totally disregard that the other party has their beliefs and agendas, and to just absolutely disregard it and say it's fantasy land. I think John Boehner is living in a fantasy land, and I think that is the problem that a lot of individuals, whether Democratic or Republican, we feel that there is very little cooperation. And going back, and I know you're not talking about Netanyahu, but I think it's an unbelievably bad precedent for the Congress to be doing what they're doing, the House of Representatives to be doing what they're doing and inviting him.
Yeah, David, we've got it. The break is coming up. Abdurrahim Fakhar, I want to put it to you. I mean, here's the President of the United States saying, let's find a better politics. Let's work together, make this country great in this century. You're covering Washington for Al Jazeera. How does the United States government, U.S. democracy and politics look to the world when we see this kind of deep division go on and on and on and on?
Well, I mean, the expectation in large parts of the Middle East, when the Democrats lost the Congress election, was that President Obama's tone in the State of the Union would not be so upbeat and so vibrant. But on the other hand, you could argue that it's precisely because the Republicans lost that election that he had to be as upbeat and vibrant as he was. I mean, less than 2 years before the end of his term as president, not only was he throwing ideological grenades at the Republicans, things like middle class economics, which are anathema to John Boehner, as we heard, and his likes. But he is also, you know, pushing in the State of the Union. He pushed the point about immigration, for example. Jeb Bush, I mean, that to me, that was a jive at Jeb Bush as an election for 2016.
Abdurrahim, stand by. We've got a break right in front of us here. Forgive me. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. In other news this week, American Sniper has the biggest January opening in box office history, and a load of controversy here from the trailer.
I'm willing to meet my creator and answer for every shot that I took.
He'll answer for every shot he took. A big measles outbreak linked to Disneyland and maybe to the anti-vaccination movement. Disneyland visitor Chris Jacobs said he's upset with the anti-vaxxer impact.
I get really upset looking at it when I see it, you know, see the maps and stuff of all the outbreaks, because it's like, it's easily preventable. We basically had it wiped out and now it's coming back.
That much is true. And a selfie snapped at the Miss Universe pageant by Miss Israel causes a furor on his show Monday. Jon Stewart joked about the uproar and the flurry of news coverage.
Lebanese television station Al Jaheed says Miss Lebanon should have known better, that to appear in a photo with Miss Israel because Lebanon and Israel are enemies.
It's a beauty pageant. They're all enemies.
Thank you, Jon Stewart. We're looking at a week in the news with Kristen Welker of NBC News, Abdurrahim Fukara of Al Jazeera, and Jack Beatty. Lots of callers on the address here. Robert in Lake Placid, New York. Robert, you're on.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a pretty staunch conservative, okay. Self-employed, and as far as the State of the Union address that President Obama unleashed on us, it's the same thing he's been saying for 6 years, which I believe is you take from the wealthy, you give to the poor. And in this country, the United States of America is the biggest private business run in the world. And if you do not have the tax from the rich to pay for jobs for the poor and the middle class, we're going down the socialist road. And if we continue this way with everybody getting handouts, pretty soon, there's not going to be anybody to get the handout from.
Robert, I hear you loud and clear, but let me ask you the question. I've asked it before, but what do you do when there's, you know, nothing's going on with the wages of so many workers in this country, and you know what's happened with wealth at the top? I mean, you know, good for them, but it's grown like crazy. If that, what do you do in that situation? There's no growth in the median income for the most of the people in the country.
That's because there's no investment from the private sector to create more job opportunity for them, because they're scared to death. Whatever they do between health care, between taxes, they're going to get riddled. And they're, you know, 4 years ago, they started dumping their money in other countries for the simple fact that when they knew health care was coming up, they didn't want to have to pay into it, because they knew it wasn't going to be the price that we were told from our establishment in the White House.
Robert, we've got it. Kristen Welker, what do you think President Obama would say to our caller? Robert, you cover the White House here. Does President Obama have a strategy that wants to squelch, you know, investment in this country?
Well, I think, you know, that is the big debate, how to increase wages. And he would acknowledge, I think, as readily as anyone, that wages haven't increased quickly enough. And I think he pointed that out in his State of the Union address. And of course, the argument here is that if you give tax breaks to second earner families, $500 tax breaks, as he is proposing, $3,000 tax breaks per child, that you will start to get the economy generated and going. And you give tax breaks to people so that they can go to school two for years of community college, that ultimately that will start to bring about that type of change. But you're absolutely right. This is the argument he has been making for 5 years. I think it's a great point. And that is why it's a political argument to some extent. And he's saying, look, it hasn't increased quickly enough. It hasn't, the economy hasn't improved quickly enough, but we are seeing some significant improvements when you look at the unemployment rate, when you look at housing prices. And so I think the argument here is to continue to take those types of steps and you'll see more improvement. But certainly, I think that one of his goals here is to say, hey, this is the argument the Democrats should have made in 2014 because they could have had stronger gains in the midterms. And again, laying out the groundwork for 2016.
Jack, are we going to have the same debate going into 2016 that we seem to have had since, you know, 1980 about, you know, trickle down or grow up or grow from the middle, as the White House likes to say now?
Undoubtedly. Undoubtedly. You know, the president calls for $320 billion in tax increases over a decade. But, you know, looking at it with Robert's fears in mind, I'm hard pressed to see privation here. For example, the capital gains rate would just go up to what it was under Ronald Reagan. That doesn't sound so bad. It wasn't so bad to be rich then. The tax on heirs, on wealthy people who can put things in trust, that's just sitting there in trusts. From Robert's point of view, yes, it's their money, but it's not doing anything for the economy. It's just tied up. I mean, we're not talking here about, or, you know, how about a fee on the largest banks with $50 billion or more? Gee, I'm okay with that. I mean, they're doing so well. Can't they kick in a little bit? The point is, it's hard to see anything here that would really hurt economic growth. On the contrary, putting it down where people spend it, that looks like it would help growth.
Let's get another from upstate New York. Ithaca, fairly upstate. Carl is on calling. Hi, Carl. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. Nice to hear you. I'm responding to this term, redistribute the wealth, because that somehow assumes that it resides where it should and that it wasn't redistributed back. Let's go back to the beginning of Reagan. And basically, it's been redistributed upwards, not just through tax policy, but I would say this past, this new century, we've been at war. The war, the way we indulge the oil industry, all those things have moved the wealth upwards. So this term is very misleading, and along with class warfare. They're very misleading terms. And I would say that my only problem with Obama's speech was he didn't hit infrastructure bigger. Infrastructure is not just fixing roads. I think we need a major, major program that will hire people, get kids interested in engineering instead of computers or along with computers. And I just think this term, redistribute the wealth, is It's sickening.
Well, Carl, we've got it. We've got a dissent from your corner there. Certainly the wealthy have done very well in plenty of recent years here. Kristen, I want to ask you about one thing that unfolding this week in Washington around abortion and the GOP. The Republicans scaled back the scope of the anti-abortion legislation that they had on the table. And the reporting was that it was in part because Republican women on Capitol Hill were not happy with it. What's going on there?
That's right. They felt as though it was too harsh of a measure, banned abortions after a certain number of weeks. And what's fascinating about it is that it really exposes this divide within the Republican Party, not just with women, but there are a lot of establishment Republicans who were concerned about this legislation as well because it was such stringent legislation. And again, the goal for the GOP in 2016, if they want to win the White House, which is their key focus right now, is to reach out to a broader base to get more women on board. And remember, that was a big problem for them in 2012, that they just didn't have the number of women voters that they needed ultimately to win, or the number of Latino voters, for example. The president trounced Mitt Romney when you looked at the numbers. So there's some concern that, look, by getting bogged down in some of this legislation, that you continue to alienate some of those people that you need to get on board and that you need to be recruiting as we get closer to 2016.
Let's hear a little of the sound maybe of that openness. This is Republican Jackie Walorski out of Indiana, talking about women in health care. And of course, the GOP pulled back. Here she is.
We have a responsibility as the elected body representing our constituents to protect the most vulnerable among us and ensure that women facing unwanted pregnancies do not face judgment or condemnation, but have positive support structures and access to health care to help them through their pregnancies.
A little different tone there, maybe, from the GOP. Also, an interesting note, immigration's come up a couple of times. No mention of it in the response to the President's State of the Union by Republican Senator Joni Ernst out of Iowa, but in the Spanish Well, what was initially billed as a strict translation of Ernst's address, it came from a freshman congressman from Miami, Carlos Curbelo, delivering that. He did talk about immigration, even though she didn't. Here's a little bit.
También trabajemos por los canales apropiados para crear soluciones permanentes.
Not there from Senator Ernst, but in the Spanish version, for Spanish listeners, we should also work through the appropriate channels to create permanent solutions for our immigration system. Kristen, that was pretty interesting. So one version in English, another in Spanish.
It is interesting, and I think it underscores how big of a political problem this could potentially be for Republicans. Of course, you have the president coming out issuing this executive order, which Republicans said they're opposed to because essentially he is, abusing his executive power, that he doesn't have the authority to do this. And again, it just underscores another divide within the Republican Party. How do they deal with this issue of immigration? They know it's a problem. You have Marco Rubio making this a key issue. But how do they turn from, I believe the president beat Mitt Romney 70% to 20% among Latino voters in 2012. How do you go from that number to grow them significantly in 2016?
Let's go to Travis in Burlington, Vermont. Travis, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. My comment was regarding American Sniper. I watched it last night, and I was sort of blown away by people's responses, sort of claiming that it was really pro-war or saying that, as evidenced by the fact that the majority of people sort of in the Midwest saw it on the right. And sort of when you watch it, I mean, it really is. I mean, Bradley Cooper is truly incredible in the film precisely because he portrays such a complicated photo. And if you watch it and come away with anything other than this was a really horrible experience and you ask a lot of people to do a lot of things that are really, really terrible and it just sort of stretches them to their breaking point. I mean, I'm not going to say it's completely anti-war, but it just seems a lot more like this is sort of the chaos that war unleashes. And I mean, I think that it's really helpful in sort of our reckoning with the Iraq and Afghanistan war as we begin to withdraw from those areas, if we withdraw from those areas. And I think that this film was an important step sort of in that direction along the lines of Full Metal Jacket or other films that came out after Vietnam, which don't necessarily question sort of the morality of the war specifically, but the morality of all war. So thank you.
Travis, I'm glad you called on that front from Burlington. Jack Beatty, really interesting this week to see how much response there's been to this in so many ways. I haven't seen it yet. Seen the trailer, very compelling trailers they've got out there on television. It makes you want to see it, and many, many people have huge box office. But then this pushback of Michael Moore and then others saying, you know, snipers are not so great. Snipers are the, what was it, like shoot them in the back guys of war and all that. Chris Kyle, the real-life American sniper on whom Bradley Cooper's performance is modeled, of course, ended up being killed at the hands of another former serviceman. But an interesting still working through the Iraq war that's gone on this week as this film came out to so much box office rush, Jack.
Yes, and I was listening to an expert on the business talking about this, and he said part of the genius of this was the title. American Sniper. You know, it's not the Hurt Locker. What is that? That was an. It's hard to even know what that is. Or you know, Zero Dark 30. What's that? And the fellow was saying, you got to have high concept labels on movies so people get what they're about. And that American part of it, just as clear as could be. And out in the heartland, Oklahoma, Texas, Arkansas, people have been coming in. The audience is much older than the usual audience, and it's gone over as a big hit with them. And I haven't seen it, but you know, Michael Moore's comment, certainly as it applies to his uncle, was shot in the World War II by a sniper, perfectly understandable in the family. They would regard the sniper with contempt. But you know, that's a kind of romantic view of war. I mean, snipers are part of what war is, and this man served his country very honorably and apparently with crushing crushing weight on his own psyche, or at least his own morality. He had to square all that shooting and killing with his conscience. And so I think it is part of the coming to grips with the Iraq war. And crucially, people can know what it's about and can go to see it with its, you know, with its high concept label.
The real life sniper, Chris Kyle, later worked on Sarah Palin's security team. She said this week, Hollywood left us. The rest of America knows you're not fit to shine Chris Kyle's combat boots, incendiary as always. But still, the U.S., Americans working out still a war, even as we're withdrawing. Gabe in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Gabe, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Sure. Hey, Tom. So this is probably, one of the least important stories of the week, but I'd say it's getting the most fervor, and that's, what they're calling a Deflategate.
The New England Patriots allegedly letting the air out of a whole lot of balls or whatever happened there for their last game on the way to the Super Bowl.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, Tom, it's been blown way out of proportion. You know what I mean? It's fueled by the media, sports media, and, some of the worst are the people right here in Boston. And now they're trying to get people to say that, there's, a rift between Brady and Belichick. No, no. Don't listen to it. Let's have a great Super Bowl. May the best team win. Go Pats.
Hey, okay, we see where you come out. Here's Tom Brady, Patriots, at his press conference yesterday on Deflategate.
I'm not squeezing the balls. I'm not, that's not part of my process. I grab it. I feel the lace. I feel the leather.
Boy, Jack, I can never remember hearing so much about balls, footballs, in a week of news, Jack. Where are we here?
we're in new territory. Coach Belichick said, in 40 years in football, I've never found out about these balls. Well, one really has to wonder. I like the line in the Times today. I mean, the score, after all, was 45-7 beating of the Colts. And the Times said, Pats probably could have used a medicine ball and won.
Oh, I don't know.
But it does, as everyone has pointed out, fit into a pattern. I mean, Belichick and the Pats had to take a fine and lose a number one draft pick in, 2007?
Has that happened?
For spying, yes.
Oh, before, that's, you mean, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
For spying on other people's defensive practices and trying to, learn secrets. So, we'll just have to see what happens.
Nobody wants a pall over the Super Bowl, but we may just have it. Kristen Welker, is this on your screen? What do you say about the Pats?
Well, first of all, I'm from Philadelphia. I'm an Eagles fan,
okay.
Full disclosure.
Okay.
I watched the press conference yesterday, both of them. I thought it was fascinating, and I thought the thing that stood out for me was that Tom Brady said that the NFL hadn't contacted him yet.
Yeah.
I think that's a problem for the NFL. Mm. I think that they have to resolve this before the Super Bowl. People are excited about the Super Bowl. They want to enjoy it, and they don't want this cloud hanging over it. So I think the NFL's got to act pretty quickly to put this to rest.
Get the chips and dip ready. Kristen Welker at NBC News, White House correspondent. Thank you so much, Kristen.
Thank you.
From Al Jazeera, Washington Bureau Chief Abdurrahman Fukara, great to have you. Thank you for joining us today.
Great to be with you, Tom, as always.
And Jack, thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Same to all of you good listeners. Thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.